Okay, show of hands. Should we play Miles for the rest of the day or do the panel? Looks like a 50-50 split. All right, we'll do the panel. It's the roundtable panel, WAMC's morning show where we talk about things that are happening. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue today. Joe, a touch of the old ennui. He should be back tomorrow, weather permitting. The panel today, it's a good one. And if you want to join us, please feel free to email. Just keep them brief, to the point, no links, and do proofread if you can. We have trouble enough with English without having to figure out what you mean. The email address is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And a great panel today. Let's start with, hey, that was her little Miles there. That's nice. I tell you what, let's start with the person I have not met, Albany's Chief City Auditor, Dorcia Pleers. Welcome to the show. Nice to meet you.
Good morning. Good morning, and thank you for the warm welcome. Nice to meet you also.
How did you get dragged into this?
I have no clue. I'm still asking myself that question.
Oh, me too. I got to tell you, I have the same question. WAMC's Alan Shartok, our exalted leader, is here. Good morning, sir.
Exalted is a little excessive. Nevertheless, indeed, I'm delighted to be here. I'm also very happy that I got out, as I always do, after I talked to David Christine at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
That I got out and did my, you know, miles, because it's pouring in Great Barrington right now, no matter what the weather report says.
Now, you're sort of a nut, a health nut. You walk in the rain anyway, right?
I do. Okay. I do. I haven't missed a day for a long, long, long time, way over a year, because, you know, that's what they tell you to do, so I do it.
Have you ever calculated how many miles you have walked in your life?
I have not. However, I have an app that will tell me, you know, and it'll tell me, and I'll tell you.
All right. Well, you know, I suspect over the course of your life, you have walked enough miles to reach the moon, which I suggest you try. Jim Hendler is here.
Respectfully, you mean.
Yeah, respectfully, exalted one. Jim Hendler is here, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. Well, it's a long intro, Jim. The show's almost over. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing okay. Good to talk to you, Ray. Been a while.
Okay, and we will get to the geeky portions of the show soon, and I'm glad you are here. We have some things I got to figure out with IP addresses and stuff, so we'll hold off on that for now. Also here, and this is exciting, Edward Hamilton, Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI, Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Fran Berman, Francine, it's been a long time. How are you?
My friend, Ray, I am so excited. All miles, all the time. Alan's in cyberspace. I love it.
Yeah, this is great. And you know what? It's a little different not having to see all of you in the studio. And, you know, there are pluses and minuses to that. But in general, technologically speaking, over the course of this pandemic, we've made it work. You know, it ain't perfect, but it. And a reminder, Fran and all the panelists, if for some reason your signal drops, we'll try to bring you back in the show. Once again, the address is panel@wamc.org if you want to join in. President Joe Biden addressed Congress, nationally televised last night. He declared America is rising anew, and he called for expansion of federal programs to drive the economy, extend the social safety net on a scale not seen in a really long time, a $1.8 trillion proposal to invest in children, families, and education. Alan, I think you probably had a chance to digest this. What do you think?
Well, I did, and I thought he did a great job. Of course, the right wing is out there saying he mumbled or he was slow, you know, but what can you expect for the likes of Tucker Carlson and some of those others?
You watch Tucker Carlson at night?
No. I don't. I happen to know what he said because I got told by somebody who told me what he said, and it wasn't good. The question becoming with these right-wing guys is, do they believe their own garbage, or are they just making it up in order to solidify within the ranks of the right wing? I must say, the idea of community college free for everybody, hey, I've said it 1,000 times. I went to Hunter. I looked in the Bronx, and I look around, and It was absolutely free, and all the people who were there, a good number of those people never would have made it to college otherwise. So I think the ideas of things like community college for all, tax credits for having children. This country is in real trouble right now. I don't know if you've been watching, but it's stagnating. And I think that was a Trumpian idea. That's why he didn't want to let anybody into the country, because he knew the more people got in, the more Democrats there were going to be. And somebody's going to write me and say, you can't make that assumption. Oh, yeah, I can. Oh, yeah.
Dorsey Appleers, you have your finger on the red and black lines of a budget often, and you're looking at things. This is by all descriptions, a very ambitious proposal. It's a costly proposal. Is there a way, have you had a chance to look at these proposals, and is there a way to make it work with simply capital gains, increased taxes, and taxing the rich?
Yes, and you started with the notion, you know, are we digesting this? And I can honestly say for me, it is so much to digest. I am still chewing on it. This is a very comprehensive set of policies with a huge ticket price. And in speaking with some of my colleagues in the state legislature, many have said this is the best budget that they have been a part of at the state level because of the decisions being made at the federal level. And do I think that it's doable, it's possible? Yes. When we think about the wealth that has been accumulated among the most wealthiest in our country, even during the pandemic, you know, the money is there. And the Biden administration is not being apologetic about the desire to tax the wealthy, the corporations, the 1%, to ensure that they are paying their fair share. And in doing so, that seeks to fund a good portion of the funds that will be required to roll this out, these comprehensive policies out. And I think Corinne Jean-Pierre, who is the principal deputy press secretary, said it best. She said, President Biden is meeting this moment. And it is a historic moment. And for those who have been doing social service work, this is a major investment in safety nets in a way that we haven't seen, I think, since President Lyndon B. Johnson in 1964, 1965. And so while many are celebrating that these safety nets are being put in place and reinforced to help the most vulnerable among us, to help our middle class, as Alan mentioned, there are those who feel that this is nothing more than a gravy train. And so the polarization that we're hearing, that we're seeing, couldn't be any more clear when it comes to some of the most important issues of the day. And then the last point that I'll make, you know, it's, again, so much to digest.
Yeah.
And even watching Senator Tim Scott's rebuttal, this notion that some of the benefits that we're seeing now, the silver lining in as it relates to the pandemic, you know, this should be a nod to the Trump administration. And while I, as it relates to COVID, I do see, and I did hear President Trump really get on the bullhorn about expediting vaccines. I think the major difference in what we're seeing right now is how well the Biden administration is implementing and rolling out some of these bold policy ideas.
You know, Jim Hendler, you've been following the numbers on the COVID pandemic, and you've done a spectacular job of sort of distilling the data. And there's been so much crazy data over the last 13, 14 months. One of the responses the Republicans had to Joe Biden's speech, and Joe rightfully or not rightfully took a great deal of credit for really moving the recovery efforts and stamping out the pandemic, or at least doing his best to do that. One of the things the Republicans said was, hey, listen, all of these mechanisms were in progress before you came in office, Joe, and now you're reaping the benefits. True, not true, Jim Hendler, number cruncher.
So, you know, Ray, the issue is that you look at the numbers and you can almost see the change in all the curves when Biden took over, and particularly a couple weeks after Biden took over, where you start to see his new people starting to set policy, starting to do things. But of course, that was also when the vaccines were coming out. Most people do give Trump administration, because there's some debate about just how on board Trump himself was for getting the vaccination stuff going. But certainly the rollout, the getting it to people, the dysfunction. I mean, remember what it was like at the beginning when you just simply couldn't find the vaccines, and then it was turning out that they hadn't even shipped them, and states were saying, you know, we didn't get what they promised us. All of that kind of dysfunction is gone, and the number of shots that would have gotten onto the arms under the Trump policies is insanely low compared to where we are now.
Hey,
so I think,
hey Jim, you gotta at least think about Trump in the beginning getting up and saying there wasn't going to be a crisis in the United States.
I mean, you know, again, the whole handling of COVID along the way. I was focusing just very specifically on this one about the vaccines.
Got it.
Getting the vaccines developed was something that everybody agreed we had to do. It's unclear to me just how much the administration had to do with that other than the investment, which was serious. But getting it out and getting it into people's arms, that this administration has done so much better than anything we were seeing, and that's what turned the numbers around. Then one last thought on the thing, just you know, a small shout out to those of us who do research, but his, you know, let's look to the future as well as the current time and invest in research was exciting to hear. And he's the first president ever to say the term artificial intelligence in a State of the Union like address. So I just want that noticed. It's a moment in history for us geeks.
You made Fran Berman giggle. Fran, go ahead.
I always love it when they mention science, and we're hearing a lot about science from Biden. I was thrilled with this. You know, he's going for the long game, and that of course has a bit of a risk, but if you think about it, you know, FDR's New Deal really provided infrastructure for generations of success. Right. And this is like Biden's newer deal. And he's really providing all kinds of tools and skills we need for success in the 21st century. If you think about it, he's thinking about health, you know, his first big bill about corona, and really setting the stage to deal with future pandemics better. He's thinking about physical infrastructure, but he's thinking about that really broadly. You know, he's including broadband. He's including the people required to do that. He's thinking about investments in the tools we need to be successful, science and education, and all kinds of, you know, administrative infrastructure. He wants to, you know, fix the IRS. He's thinking of ways to pay for this, and those ways provide a more equitable way of assessing, you know, what people owe, you know, having the wealthier corporations and the wealthier individuals pay for it and not put that on the backs of the government or individuals that pay less. That's a big deal. So I just think it's a bold agenda. It's delivered in kind of a gentle and non-finger-pointing way, which I really appreciate. You know, every time somebody just sort of points their fingers to a group and says all of them are bad and all of us are good, I just don't think that advances the conversation. And, you know, no matter who says what, you know, he kind of stays the course on, you know, it's a problem all of us have. Let's all of us do it together, reaching my hand across the aisle, while staying firm on the things he wants to happen. So, you know, I was thrilled with this. I thought it was great.
It's the roundtable panel. Alan, I have a political question for you, and then I'll let you jump in here.
I had a question for Fran.
All right.
Whether
rank on me here? So go ahead. You ask your question
yes,
first.
Yes,
you know what?
Yes,
I'm offended and I'm going to leave now. Go ahead.
Yes, that's exactly right.
whatever.
Okay. So yeah. Yes, Fran, here's the question. If you have to name the Biden approach, you know, everything has a deal in it, or a new deal, whatever. Would you call this, you mentioned, the newer deal? I like that a lot. And the other one
well,
was.
Well, I made that up. It's not official.
And the other one was big deal. So maybe this could be called the big deal. I'm sorry, Ray. What did you want to ask me that my profound mind could answer?
You know, and I was zoning out during your question, so I hope it was a good one. But my question, and you only have about 2 minutes to answer this question, but Fran brought up a very interesting point about the speech last night, in that Joe Biden, you know, sort of in a general way discussed ways to pay for what is ultimately going to be trillions in spending if this hard and soft infrastructure plan goes through.
STR.
And my question for you is, from a political standpoint, with midterm elections coming up and knowing the history of sort of the opposite party from the president swinging in a positive direction.
Yes.
Is the timing right? In other words, will the Democrats pay a political price for what is going to be ultimately a program that costs people, taxpayers, some money?
Well, it depends on who it costs. That's why they picked the $400,000 cutoff mark. If you make less than $400,000, which most of us don't, then you're okay. And of course, everybody, STR, soak the rich, everybody says, that's good, let them pay. I'm for it. However, the history of this country is we have something called K Street with all them lobbyists there who give money to political campaigns for guys who run for the House and women who run for the House of Representatives and the Senate. That's how it's done in this country. So I wouldn't assume that the people's will of soaking the rich will mean anything here, because in the end, that's not the way our politics works. I know there must have been something else I wanted to say, but, you know.
Well, you have
chuck it up to old age.
You have 90 seconds, actually 1 minute, so go ahead. You say whatever you want now.
Okay, Ray.
We're going to break for news soon, so it's all yours, Shar Talk. Take it, Daddy.
You always say, but I always love it when you say, we're going to break for British news now.
Okay.
That's always a wonderful moment.
All right, well, let's go around the room, and we have about 45 seconds here. We'll give a letter. This means nothing, of course, but we'll give a letter grade to President Biden's 100-day speech. Dorsey appears. What do you think?
A-.
Jim Hendler.
I was also going A-.
Why the minus?
Yeah.
The delivery.
Okay.
I thought the delivery was very good for him, but he's not the best speaker compared to some of the famous speeches we've heard here.
Fran Berman.
I agree with Jim, but you asked about the speech, not the delivery. I thought he gave about as good of a delivery as Joe Biden gives. So, you know, like A for what he can do and A for the speech.
All right, fair enough.
Okay, that's fair.
And I say A+, and I'm going to tell you why.
Okay, you have 10 seconds.
All this stuff about people saying, well, you know, it was the best speech. He's not the best speechifier. I think, you know, it's like when somebody who has a stutter, you get a little closer and you listen real carefully. And I think that's what happens. So I'm giving him an A+.
All right, we're done now. We've got to take a break for the Brit News. We'll be back on the Roundtable panel at WAMC.org. All Miles, all the time here on the Roundtable panel. It's a Thursday morning, 9:34. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. The panel is in progress, don't you know? You can join the fun by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. We use the term fun loosely. Some people find it fun. On the panel today, we have, Fran Berman is here, Jim Hendler, Dorsey Appleers, Alan Shartok, and, of course, you. We got an email here from Russ. And Russ says, I understand Biden's strategy in putting big initiatives on the table at the start of his presidency to allow for a long runway to build popular support. But I expect successful counter-strategy by Republicans to cast themselves as the prudent party and cement a senatorial majority in 2022. So the Republican gambit will be to delay, by any means, all significant legislation for the next 2 years. I guess that's in the wheelhouse of our buddy Alan Chartok. What do you think? Oh, he's not there.
Well, no, I'm here.
Oh, hi.
I got to think about these things, you know.
Yeah.
If I could find my microphone, it would be particularly
that would,
helpful.
Well, yeah, it sounds all right.
Here it is. I got it. I was sitting on it like an egg.
Well, no wonder it sounded so good. Hey, go ahead.
You are too much. So, I think that will be the strategy, except it's so hypocritical. Because, obviously, the Republicans were spending out of sight, but on the wrong things. They were, you know, giving the rich tax breaks. They were doing all of those things. Here comes Biden with what could either be called the new deal, the newer deal, or the big deal.
Big deal.
Because Americans are going to make out as a result of this. They're going to get all kinds of help for their kids. You know, I was thinking we looked at the stats from the census, and we found out that that this country was stagnant, which I believe was, you know, there'll be people who accuse me of conspiracy theory here, but Trump didn't want to let anybody into the country. They were going to skew Democratic, and he didn't want a lot of population. So this country is in bad shape when it comes to progressing, and I'd love to hear from our statistical people on that, but clearly out of the census data, that's what happened. Now comes along Biden. He says, let more people into the country. He says, we got to let everybody go to community college for free. He does the kinds of things. We got to increase health care and the way we do health care in this country. He did say no Medicare for all, but he did say we got to do better, and he's doing better. So from that point of view, he's encouraging those people who are going to get something out of this, and I think most people will recognize that. The other guy was always sort of doing racism. Speaking of which, the Republican reaction to this was just awful last night, and a disgrace. So I think those are the reasons I gave him an A+.
Anybody else?
Ray, I have a question for Al.
Okay, Dorsey, sorry. You go first, then Fred.
Go ahead, Dorsey.
Thanks. You know, before the break, I didn't get a chance to get my comments in about my A-.
Yeah.
And so I essentially am embodying all of the professors I've had over the course of my academic career. And the notion is, in my class, in order to get a solid A, it takes more than a well-delivered speech. And for those of us on the ground implementing some of these policies and plans, like, for example, the vaccine rollout, it takes a lot of work to make sure that there is equitable distribution of shots in people's arms. And so it sounds great, but the you know, we still have a lot of work to do to ensure all of these bold ideas come to fruition. But the other point that I want to make is that the big hairy ape in the room here is the pandemic, the fallout. People are still hurting. People are in a bad shape financially. And so I think the Biden administration is really using this moment and leveraging this moment, and it's providing the political cover necessary to push through progressive and bold policies and ideas that we probably would not have been able to accomplish under different circumstances. And so while the Republicans, I'm sure, are cringing, no one, and they're already looked at as being villains on a lot of these issues that are important to people, the American people in this moment, I think they are carefully balancing trying to regain some of their footing and power and not come across as being the villain in this whole situation.
Fran Berman.
Well, I have a government 101 question for Alan and the rest of you. And so my question is, why do we have a rebuttal to the State of the Union? Isn't the State of the Union a speech by the president to Congress, you know, what he or she would like, you know, in the next year, kind of a call to arms, whatever, sharing that vision with the American people? I have no idea why the other party, whoever they may be, gives a rebuttal to that. Why does that make any sense?
I think the reason is that the whole idea is to be, quote, fair. I don't think it is fair because, pardon me, I think last night's rebuttal was terrible or just awful. And I don't think that many people tune into it or understand it when it's happening. But I think Fran, you know, some genius probably figured out, you know, we try to at least present ourselves as the media of being fair, and that's why they get that time.
Fran, it just seems
odd to me. I'm sorry, go on.
Fran, I was going to say, I thought about the same thing this morning. I was thinking about what's the purpose in that. And I reached a similar conclusion to Alan. I think that it is a good faith effort to show democracy at work. And so while whomever is in power at the moment has the bully pulpit and platform, it is an opportunity to show democracy and allow the other side to express their concerns, rebuttal on whatever has been delivered in terms of policy issues. So I think it's a good faith way to show democracy at work.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but have you ever noticed that when the Democrats give the rebuttal, it's always much better than when the Republicans do?
Okay, this one is from another Russ. Well, it's two Russes in a row. Who knew? This one is from Russ, and Russ says, NPR's morning coverage of the president's address has been atrocious. Does news coverage these days consist only of taking a political opponent's talking points when asking representatives of the president? I wanted to scream at the radio when Ambassador Rice was being asked, do you own this Republican talking point? Why not ask specific questions about proposed programs and the arguments against them rather than addressing the specious arguments of Republicans who routinely use such unprovable arguments like government is too big and taxes are too high, statements that can be used even if two people work in the government and taxes are only $1 a year. That's from Russ. There's a rant for you. Anybody want anything on that?
So,
Jim Endler. All right, you're in. Go.
Well, actually, I was going to say something a little different and sort of do what a good speaker does and pivot off that question. So if Alan wants to address it directly, I'll let him.
Okay.
No. Go ahead.
Please do.
So my pivot was, you know, there was one... there was one thread through Tim Scott's response, which I agree with Alan was pretty terrible and was primarily just standard talking points that we've heard a million times from the Republicans. But it came much more from the sort of libertarian small government side of the party, which was somewhat quieter under Trump. And so I'm just wondering if that's going to signal sort of the direction the Republicans are going to try to go back more to their small government roots. Because, of course, when the Democrats are going to be the big spenders, that's an easy route for them to take. But sure. Also would mean some of the different people in the party will suddenly become more prevalent. And, you know, the question is, you know, he gave a lot of credit to Trump, of course, but not the kind of raw meat credit, not to mention, obviously, the... you know, putting him as the speaker had the real signal that, you know, this is, you know, we're going to try to break from that white supremacist mode of the Trump administration. So I'm just curious whether, you know, sort of the underpinning themes of this response were interesting from these points of view.
I think you're reading too much into it. You know, even with Trump, you know, who was absolutely a white supremacist, of that there is no question in my mind. But if you always saw the group that was behind him that they would put there, there was always one black person behind him. They made sure of that. And that's what we saw with Scott last night. You know, it was, I really thought it was particularly disgraceful. That he had sold out the African-American community in the United States the way that he did. And of course, it wasn't very subtle that they put their one black senator up there to do it. Maybe I have no right to say that as a white guy, but I can tell you I was really, really angry about that.
Let's take a break on that note. The email address here is panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org, and we'll get to more of your emails coming up, and a bunch of topics today on the program with Fran Berman, Jim Hendler, Dorsey Appleers, and Alan Shartok. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Yes, I usually come out of these jazz breaks and I say welcome back to Vox Pop, but it's Roundtable. So if I say Vox Pop, please, someone on the panel, just give me a slap in the head. I deserve it. It is 9:46. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. The panel today, Dorsey Appleers, who is Albany's chief city auditor. We have Tetherless World Professor of Computer Web, Cognitive Science at RPI, Director of the RPI, IBM, or God, Hendler. Jeez, it's Jim Hendler. That's enough. Fran Berman, who is a professor of computer science at RPI and at Harvard University. All of these people are on the panel today. This email came in from Tom. Tom says, someone must realize any increase in taxes on a corporation is passed down to the consumer. So it's an indirect tax on individuals. Name a product, add a tax to the corporation selling it, and see the price at the consumer level go up. Please get an economist on here. Well, you're in luck, because I believe Aaron Pasitti is on tomorrow. So we'll table that unless anyone wants to rebut.
Well, that's the traditional Republican line. You can't raise taxes. You can't expect them For goodness sake, we can't expect the rich people to pay taxes, because they'll just pass it on to all the rest of us schnooks. That's the talking point. It always has been, and it always will be.
All right. Let's see. Oh, this is interesting. Somebody has some advice for Alan that I can read. This is from Rich in Mount Kisco. How about calling Biden's program the 21st Century Deal? What do you think, Alan? All right, you're underwhelmed. All right, fair enough. Anybody else think that's a good idea?
You know, giving things a name makes a difference. So find a catchy name and call it that. But, you know, I just wanted to, you know, kind of like the shoe drop before the break, but I just wanted to say that I was really disturbed by Scott saying that America is not racist, and then telling a story, you know, of his own stop by the police and his own concerns about that. It upset me, as it did many of the rest of you, but it also, you know, it also really surprised me that he would say that.
You know, when Gene Shalit, remember Gene Shalit? He was around. He lives up here in the Berkshires. And he reviewed Ishtar, the movie Ishtar.
Yeah. Here we go.
You all remember that?
Yeah.
You know what he said? Ishtar is terrible. Ishtar is terrible. So I just like to say of Senator Scott, Ishtar is terrible.
Yeah. It's an odd way of going about your business, Alan Shartok, but let's just move on. This is from somebody. It doesn't say who. Oh, from Jim. Jim, I wish Biden would use a more common sense approach. Ask Americans if Republicans have a plan to address the problems like low wages, inability to get child care, elder care, pay for education, save for retirement, much less on the racism and gun deaths, and then ask if asking the wealthy to pay more will hurt them. Will Bezos' life be impacted if he has to pay more in taxes? The status quo is acceptable to Republicans. Their answer is to say please to the wealthy and cross their fingers that trickle-down will work, with no evidence it will. And that is from Jim. Anybody?
So, you know, one of the things a lot of the commentators said last night, and I had picked up a little bit on this too, Biden was not talking to the Republican Party in the room. he was talking to the voters of America. And, you know, he was very careful not to turn it into an us versus them kind of speech. He really, you know, he knows he's not going to get the people in that room to stand up and applaud if they're sitting on the Republican side. He knows that those politicians, you know, before they even announced the infrastructure plan, McConnell said it was dead, right? I mean, he knows he's not going to get the people in that room to do what they should unless their voters start telling them. And so I think his talk, you know, maybe I'll grade up on the curve to an A based on what I heard, because I think he was talking to the people of America. You know, he really was making a pitch that said, we need this as a country. And I think that was the sort of New Deal-ish part of it that we're picking up on here.
Last call on this one. We move on. This is the Roundtable Panel. The email address is panel@wamc.org. Great panel today. Dorsey Appleers, Alan Chartok, Jim Hendler, and Fran, don't call me Francine Berman, with us today on the program. This is from Ruth. Ruth says, Martin Ginsburg, famous tax expert and Ruth Bader Ginsburg's husband, said this about tax lobbyists in testimony before the Ways and Means Committee in 1982. Quote, the tax bar is a repository of the greatest ingenuity in America, and give them the opportunity, they will do you in. Alan Chartok.
Correct. That is exactly right. Look, what happens is, as soon as somebody puts something legitimate on the table that might equalize some of the haves and have-nots, they go to K Street and they say to the lobbyists, "Here, let us give you some money. You can go out, and while you may not want to give the campaign contribution, everybody knows what the game is. You're going to find somebody who will. You know, the lobbyists divide up with the people in the party. You know, so that's what happens, and he's exactly right."
Anybody else? Silence. Blessed relief. This is from Kathleen. Kathleen says, I agree with Alan. There are many effective oratorical styles. Everything doesn't have to be a fiery rhetoric. It was a perfect speech and tone for this time. I give it an A+. We needed this. And that's from Kathleen.
There you go.
Next. This is from Serena. The panel spoke highly about the New Deal without recognizing that African Americans were denied many of the benefits of the New Deal, including ability to unionize in agriculture and domestic industries, and to get federally backed loans to purchase homes. FDR was lukewarm on supporting desegregation. This must be raised. I hope Biden's plan is not another New Deal / raw deal for African Americans. Panel.
That's a good letter.
That's a really good point. And I do think that the Biden administration is really trying to be very sensitive to the inequities and to proactively try to fix them. And I do think there are you know, as everybody said, there's a lot to sort through here. But I do think people are trying to address those kinds of issues as well as a whole host of other kinds of issues. But what a great letter.
Dorsey Appleers.
Yeah, and I, you know, that underscores why my minus stands, because, you know, it can sound good and it can look good, but what that looks like when it comes to implementing and advocating for equity at the ground level is two totally different things. And so I think it goes back to the some of the conversation that we've been having in terms of who was Biden talking to. And so he is very clear who put him in office. And so there were a lot of promises made that he now has to deliver on. African Americans put Biden in office. And so women, in particular black women, were the force to put Biden in office. And so he is talking to a constituency that is holding him and his administration accountable in a way that that accountability has been there for other administrations, But this is different, and this is unique, and a unique moment. And so, you know, I agree with the sentiment. There are oftentimes these great ideas, but Black people, people of color, oftentimes get left out and don't benefit from some of these deal, quote unquote, deals.
Alan.
I think that is a brilliant analysis. I think it's exactly right. Look, Black voters did put Biden in office. There's no question. South Carolina, wasn't that where it started? There's no question that he has really done his best to honor that commitment. Now, whether he believes it, I think he does. There are those who probably think it's just political, but he has really been doing what he was elected to do by the community that elected him. Period.
You know, we only have about 2 minutes here before we have to break for news. But I thought about this week, and there's been much ballyhoo about the 100-day mark of the presidency. And if you think back, this goes back several presidents now. And I'll ask Alan, you have a long institutional memory, and you have been following politics.
You mean I'm old?
Yeah. And so how long has this 100, sort of arbitrary 100-day benchmark been set?
Well, basically, I have no idea, but I'm sure it has been. I mean, it's an arbitrary thing. The press loves it. People are able to get their minds around it. And so it makes a lot of sense. I don't know how long. I would leave that to, you know, more prescient people like yourself, Ray, to answer.
I don't have a laptop here, so I can't give you an answer of any kind. I just have papers.
Well, let me just say, I'm a great admirer of Joe Biden. I really am. I was from the very beginning, as people who listen to me know, and I think we're very lucky to have him.
You know, 100 days, it's been fairly eventful given the pandemic and some of the things already happened, either via Congress or executive action, and Biden has certainly done his share of those. First 100 days, he had the American Rescue Plan. That was a big plan. COVID-19 vaccine distribution. We rejoined the Paris Agreement. The permit for the Keystone XL pipeline revoked. We only have 30 seconds. So once again, we'll get a letter grade. Fran Berman, the first 100 days of the Biden presidency.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know the history of it either, but I think it makes a lot of sense. You set out an early milestone. That milestone demonstrates that, you know, you've hit the ground running. You are making a serious attempt to do what you said you would do. You know, it's a time when we have the sliverest majority in the, or not majority, but we can pass things in the Senate. So, yeah, you know, go big or go home. And I think, you know, his first 100 days
like
is showing
it.
That.
Okay, what's your letter grade?
Definitely. A+.
Oh, A+. Jim Hendler.
Definitely A. I don't give A+.
All right.
I'm a tough grader.
Dorsey Appleers?
On this, I'll give him an A for setting the tone and setting the table.
Alan Shartok.
I like it. I'm sticking with my A+. It was hard to get an A for me back in the day when I was doing all my teaching. But I think he's done very well. And when you find somebody who's done very well, you should reward them.
You are mellowing with, you're like a tawny port. You are mellowing with age. It's the Roundtable panel.
Port.
Yes, indeed. Delicious. Panel@WAMC.org is our email address. Panel@WAMC.org. Jim Hendler, Fran Berman, Dorsey Appleers, Alan Shartok make up the panel. Oh, there's a lot more to go after news. Miles Davis is good for the soul. I think the Surgeon General said that one time. The email address here is panel@WAMC.org. We're doing the panel, and it goes until about 10:48 this morning if you're scoring at home. Great panel with us. Fran Berman, Jim Hendler, Alan Shartok, and Dorsey Appleers. And Dorsey, I don't want to put you too much on the spot here, but as we just heard in the newscast, you're part of an ongoing working group focusing on further police reform in the city of Albany. You signed a letter last week with several common counselors criticizing the police force's response when it cleared protesters from outside South Station on Thursday. The mayor told WAMC yesterday she still has confidence in the command staff. Do you?
I would say that I would never lose confidence and hope. That being said, I am clear that many of our residents have lost confidence and hope. And so that's the role of folks like myself in public service who have been elected to lead and serve. We have to work even harder to restore that hope and trust because it for many, it's not there.
What's the path forward then?
Change, actual change. I think conversations are great, but we, people are tired of talking. And so we need a culture shift when it comes to public safety and police reform. And so it's not just training. It's not just policy. I've said before, culture eats policy for breakfast. And so we have to implement actions that fundamentally shift the culture of public safety. And so while the new buzzwords are reimagine and reinvent, if you're not careful, it will all be lipstick on a pig if you don't change the culture of our police departments and how we interface with them as a community.
Does anybody else want to jump in here?
Well, we certainly know that the way in which we recruit our police, the people who come forward to be in the police, really does have to be attended to. We need police. Don't let me have any mistake about this. We need to have police, but the people that are recruited, the people who are there, have to be sensitized to what they're doing, and we have to get a different applicant pool, in my opinion, who will be more likely to obey the standards I'm sort of laying out for you here. And by the way, the idea that the police department, which have their names on their badges, cover those names up tells you more than you want to know.
Dorsey,
I had a question for you. This is Fran. I've been thinking a lot about culture change in my own world, which is the world of tech, which, is kind of a wild west out there and needs a lot of control. And those of us in academia, Jim and I and lots of other people, I think, are playing the long game, which is to try to provide current and next generations of people with the skills and the knowledge and the tools to actually take control of an environment. But of course, I hear in your voice fatigue, and I feel the same way myself. And we need short-term and medium-term solutions as well for culture change. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are about, in your world, but, it applies to my world too, how we might accomplish that.
Who are you? Dorsey.
Yeah. Okay, great. Can I just apologize for a minute? I got a spam call, and I said, good grief. I wasn't reacting to anybody on the...
I don't even think we heard that.
Anybody on the... Okay, great.
No harm, no foul, Alan.
Well, Alan, I did not hear you, but I was saying the same thing because, that's a loaded question, and, the weight of the question, because there's no quick fixes here. There's no easy answer or solution. Some say if you change leadership, and what we know is that you can change leadership, you can change the demographics. Some people say, oh, you have a black police chief. Everything should be perfect. And the reality is the systems that are governing every aspect of our lives are operating the way they were intended to operate. And so you can change the player, but if the system is perpetuated by new players, you get the same outcomes. And so, we really have to change the systems, fundamentally break them down, rebuild, so that we truly create a culture that is inclusive, that is respectful of others, one that is not so deeply embedded with biases and racism that we know exist. And, you know, Alan brought up a point about recruitment. It's a sad day when you have little children. I was speaking to an elementary school, a class, and I asked the kids, if you saw someone fighting, would you call the police? And they said no. And I asked why, and they said, because I don't feel safe. They said, I think the police would escalate. They didn't use the word escalate, but essentially what they were saying, I think the police would escalate the issue and someone would get hurt. And so it's difficult to diversify a police force when people feel so strongly about what it means to be a police officer and how that may be contrary to you know, what they believe as a human being and how they feel when they interface with police officers. So, you know, we have to change the culture and see change in order to recruit the types of candidates that we want to see patrolling our streets and interfacing with our community members.
You know, I think that's a really good point. The other thing that I notice here is a certain tone deafness on the part of the police and the authorities. I mean, you know, regardless of whether it was the right thing to move on that group or not, the way they did it just was with complete impunity. Like, you know, we can do what we want. And it just seems to me that that's got to change too. And I don't know how that gets changed. It's all of the things you were just talking about. But, you know, really, you must understand that in this day and age, you can't just say 15 minutes and then, you know, we come and sweep things out. There could have been discussion. There could have things that may or may not have ended up the same way. But there was no reason to not try to be, you know, try to reach a way of getting there without beating up people. I mean, it just really seemed to me, I've been, you know, a supporter of the mayor for a long time, but this one just seemed totally tone deaf.
You know, this email from Gary uses, I think, that phrase. Gary writes, I was present at Occupy Albany and found the police behavior there quite different. While the current incident is different in all details, the significant factors are that it was about police behavior and primarily about black people. The handling of the present situation was tone deaf and insensitive. That is the ugly situation still not resolved. And that is from Gary.
What can I say? But I agree.
Yeah.
You know, it is interesting that the police are having a tough time recruiting these days, which is, you know, there are certain groups of people who psychologically get attracted to police work. And if, in fact, the police are being told, no, you cannot continue to do this and to adopt the phrase of the letter tone in its tone deaf way, we don't want you and we're going to hold you, George Floyd, we're going to hold you responsible. And all of a sudden, some people, not all, but some people don't want to be cops anymore. Are we surprised?
Well, you know, hearing nothing on that one, we will go to the next
one. Yeah, how come?
Well, it's a loaded question, Alan Chartok, and Alan's on
the
panel.
It's not loaded.
It's a tough question for anyone to come up with a proper response.
But you know what? It gets even tougher. And here's why. It's not only the police. It's the society that is racist. How far are we from the point where everybody gets a chance to have a good-paying job or a certain amount of money? And so some people get shoved to the rear. We know that. You know, Big Bill Bronzy and Pete Seeger, and they say, if you're black, get back. That's the society. So when the manifestation is the question of police and who they are a reflection of something far greater.
Dorsey, I want to get back to a statement you made earlier when we were talking about this topic. You said, I think you said, culture eats policy for breakfast. And I just wondered if you could expound on that a little bit in the specifics of this situation. And also, isn't it sort of a requirement that policy changes before culture? I mean, doesn't one lead to the other? That's my question.
You know, you can have the most well-intended policies and even legislated, but, you know, where the rubber meets the road is the enforcement, the enactment of those policies. And if you have a culture that is contradictory to the policies and the reforms that we're talking about, then it becomes just words on a page. And so even thinking about, you know, when a culture shift happens, who are the people that are more likely to be attracted to law enforcement if, in fact, we truly implement the reforms that we've been, some people have died for, Mr. George Floyd. If we are truly serious about fundamentally changing and reimagining public safety, will the demographics of our police force across the country look different? I would say yes, because I think that at that point you attract more diverse candidacy, people who otherwise felt that law enforcement work was just not for them, now feel that they can play a role in making communities feel safe. So that's essentially what I mean by that statement, and I'm not the originator of the statement, but it resonates with me as someone who served on the city's legislature and introduced legislation, advocated, fought for it, and the reality is the rubber really meets the road when it comes to the enforcement and enactment of those policies.
That's Albany's Chief City Auditor, Dorsey Appleers. We're also joined on the roundtable panel today by RPI Professor Jim Hendler, Fran Berman from RPI and Harvard, Alan Shartok from WAMC. The email address here is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Keep them brief, please, if you could, and give it a proofread before you hit send. This one's from Carol. The one major change I've heard so far is to require the police be residents of the area they serve. Reminds me of the old officer friendly. No? And that is from Carol.
You know, I just wanted to follow up on something Dorsey just said, because if you think about recruiting a new generation of police, because all of those things have to happen, culture change, institutional change, but you also want to recruit people who kind of see this as a way to provide public service rather than a way to wield power. And you can imagine that if you see yourself in this group that provides public service versus not seeing yourself in a group that wields power, you are going to get a broader and expanded set of people who are attracted to these jobs, which would make a difference.
Anybody in? Okay. Speaking of police, federal agents raided Rudy Giuliani's Manhattan home yesterday, seizing computers and cell phones in a major escalation of the Justice Department's investigation into the business dealings of the former president's personal lawyer. Giuliani, who is now 76, has been under federal scrutiny for several years over his ties to Ukraine. The dual searches sent the strongest signal yet that he could eventually face federal charges. The warrants, which require approval from the top levels of the Justice Department, signify prosecutors believe they have probable cause that Giuliani committed a federal crime, though they don't guarantee that charges will materialize. A third search warrant was served on a phone belonging to Washington lawyer Victoria Toensing, a former federal prosecutor and close ally of Giuliani and Trump. Her law firm issued a statement saying she was not a target of the investigation. At least that is what she has been told. Giuliani accusing federal authorities of a corrupt double standard, invoking allegations he's pushed against prominent Democrats, and said that the Justice Department was running roughshod over the constitutional rights of anyone involved in or legally defending former President Donald J. Trump. Alan, I give it to you first, sir. Alan is asleep. Is anybody there?
No, there I am.
Oh, hi. Welcome. Welcome back.
I turned it down.
All right.
And now I'm turning it up again. Okay. So the answer is nobody deserves it more than this guy does. You know, he plays fast and loose with law and order. He started as America's mayor. He moves up and he becomes an acolyte of Donald Trump. And if you believe, as I do, that Donald Trump was the greatest danger to this country that we have had in a long time. Then you say, okay, so what was he doing? Well, he said, and he's quoted as saying, Trump won't do anything to me. He knows better than I know too much, or something like that. You know, this is a reprehensible guy, as far as I'm concerned, and he deserves to have the greatest possible scrutiny. Now, the charge is that he goes over and he sells his services to Ukraine, as you just mentioned, and that he's lobbying the president of the United States, which is definitely against the law. If he did that, he should go to jail. That's right, J-A-I-L.
Fran Berman.
Well, it's just nice to see that the rules apply to everybody. The guy did something we all suspect is wrong, and a good investigation will prove that statement or not. And, you know, it's time to kind of move forward and not let the rules only apply to the people that the president feels like applying them to. Of course.
Jim, have you been following this one?
Yeah, I've been following it. I don't have a lot to add. I just think it's about time. I'm surprised they didn't do it earlier.
I mean,
do you think this will affect his son's, ability to run? What was the son going to run for, governor or senator? Which one? Governor, I believe. You think that this might rub off on him? You know, the father and the son and all that. Or have we heard almost nothing since he announced he might do that?
I don't know. The father-son thing didn't seem to make much of a difference leading up to the presidential election. So, I mean, who knows?
You're talking about Biden now?
Well, right? I mean, there were allegations, and it didn't seem to affect Biden's electability one bit.
I see. So you think that maybe in reference to my question that... You, Ray Graff, think that it won't happen?
I'm saying that it's fairly clear that a father-son, there is a firewall there, politically speaking, at least part of the time.
Well, let me just go on record as saying, boy, are you wrong.
Okay, we'll see.
But I may be wrong.
If he's running for governor, he's not going to win anyway. I mean, let's face it.
I'm going to get a lot of letters saying you should have told Ray he was wrong. I apologize, Ray, up front. I don't want to ever say you're wrong.
Mm-hmm. Alan Shartok is here for the time being. Dorcia Pliers is here. Jim Hendler, Fran Berman as well. You know what? We have two people, and they were joking about it this morning. Not me via the email, but Fran and Jim are very ensconced in this computer world and cognitive sciences and AI and things like this. So please make sense of this. I'll parse this for you, and then we'll take a brief break, and then we'll come back, and maybe you can explain it to me, because I'm at a loss. After weeks of wondering by the network community, the Pentagon has now provided a very terse explanation for why it hired a shadowy company residing above a Florida bank to manage a huge chunk of the internet that it owns. Many basic questions still unanswered, beginning with why it chose for this task a company that seems not to have existed until September, Global Resource Systems. And there are like 175 million IP addresses. Jim, where do I begin?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think we'll start by just letting people know what IP addresses are. So when you go to a web browser or a web app or something, and you see something like, you know, WAMC.org. WAMC.org is really 64.125.77.80 to your computer. So there's this set of numbers that are used to get the information between these different computers, and different organizations and different people own them. If you've ever had or created a website, you register, you know, foo.com, and they give you this number, or you tell them what number to assign to that. These things are worth quite a lot of money because there's a limited number of them, and there's some attempts to make that bigger. But and a lot of them were owned by the government, and a big share of them were owned by the Pentagon. And it turned out that literally 3 minutes before Biden took office, suddenly a whole bunch of that was sold to this mysterious company. And when we come back from break, I'm sure Fran and I will be happy to tell you what some of the conspiracy theories and what some of the possibilities are.
But not sold, Jim, managed. So it wasn't sold to
managed. Managed. That's, yeah. That's fair. Yes, managed.
All right. I guess the question is, why exactly do we need to care about this? Now, we only have 1 minute, but we'll pick it up on the other side. Fran, should I be worried?
Well, we just don't know what this is all about, but it sounds like it's some sort of odd, and we can specify odd, sort of pilot to really understand much more about kind of vulnerabilities on the internet and threat intelligence. So it's kind of an investigative threat intelligence pilot that was kind of weirdly rolled out. And so good questions about how it was weirdly rolled out.
Jim, you concerned?
I wouldn't say concerned. I think it either shows something, it may show something very good happening, but we're just not sure yet. And again, it'll take a few minutes to explain it, so hopefully we can do it after break, right?
Alan, I'm sure you've been following this closely. What do you think? We have 12
Absolutely.
Seconds.
I haven't got the slightest idea about any of it. I must say I tried to read it and tried to get it, but I just couldn't.
You know,
is that surprising?
No, and I'm with you there, and you are a few years older than I am, but I find the whole thing mystifying. And frankly, I only saw the topics at 7:30 this morning when I found out I was hosting the show. Otherwise, I would have vetoed this topic because I have no idea what it is. But this is the roundtable panel.
Oh, it's a fun one. It's a fun one. Malcolm Nance would be
a
all
good
one.
One.
All right, well, listen, I'll let you two expound ad nauseum on this, but we have to take a break for news. Fran Berman, Jim Hendler, Dorsey Appleers, Alan Shartok are on the roundtable panel today. You can join us by emailing panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Stand by. There's some hard-hitting IP address action coming up on the roundtable. Welcome back to the roundtable. It's 10:34. It's a Thursday morning. Rick Raff in for Joe Donahue. It's the roundtable panel until about 10:45 or so. Jim Hendler, Fran Berman, Dorsey Appleers, and Alan Shartok on the panel today. And panel, have I said welcome back to Vox Pop once today, or have I done that? No?
You've been good.
Good. By the way, a little dramatic foreshadowing. Today at 2 on Vox Pop, it's gardening today, which is always a popular show. So if you have a gardening question, today at 2 p.m., but don't write them in now. I will ignore them. Now, before we go to the next topic.
Ray, you need a tech show on Vox Pop.
We do that. You want? You want to come on, Francine? You come on
Jim
anytime.
Jim and I will come on.
All right.
We'll do it. Yeah, it'd be great. Geeking with Fran.
Can I just say, Ray, you do a terrific job on Vox Pop.
Yeah.
You used to have another guy. He wasn't nearly as good. You really are.
I don't think you should talk about Brian Shields in that way. He's retired. That's not fair. Before we move to the next.
I meant me.
I know, sir. I was trying to deflect from your obvious false modesty.
The reason I said that was because the reason I said it was not Brian Shields, because I didn't want anybody to think it was. He was terrific.
He was, and he's relaxing now. He's in his rocker. I see him with his Country Time lemonade out front as I'm driving home every day. The email address is panel@wamc.org. And before we put this topic to bed and move on, again, Jim Hendler, explain why I should care about the 175 million IP addresses that the Pentagon sold to a company that is over a bank in Florida.
So let me take a step up for a second. Let's start with the good news.
Okay.
The Trump administration really did not take cybersecurity seriously. they viewed it as totally in the context of the voting issue and the whole, and you know how political that was. So some of the key agencies in the government that oversee the safety of our internet infrastructure were hurt pretty considerably. The Biden administration has been hiring really top people. I have some very well-known friends who are now working for DHS and other agencies to try to fix some of this. So the reason this matters is, so for example, there was a story a while ago about an attempt that was made to essentially poison all the people in a small town in Florida by essentially screwing around with their water system, by somebody hacked into the control system of their water purification. It was caught almost by accident. And there have been some other cases like that. And our electrical system and many of our other systems are susceptible to these attacks. And there are coming, you know, North Korea actually funds a lot of its military by ransomware and attacks. So some of these attacks on our hospitals during COVID have now been attributed to North Korean hackers. So the good news is this administration is taking that threat much more seriously. Now, some people believe that this was sort of the first step of some of the people who really wanted to take it seriously doing something important, because one thing you could do with all of this stuff is, I won't get into the details. You can do some things that would be good protective, and that's what the Pentagon has been claiming, right? There's another group, and I wish Malcolm was here to portray these folks, who say, no, you know, this was the last blast of the Trump administration trying to, you know, take this stuff and hide it or be able to do some malicious stuff to their enemies and things like that. We'll have to see how it plays out. But right now, at the moment, it looks like, and particularly now that there's some public scrutiny, that this is probably the good guys doing something that looks like it'll be a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in history, it often happens, isn't it? Doesn't it, you know, the intelligence community will set up a little shell company and then do some things that ultimately they believe are for the good of the country? Well, this company apparently didn't even exist until late last year or in the fall. And so I would tend to agree with your assessment there, Jim.
You know, that's kind of what we believe, but of course, you know, sort of, was it Trump people doing Trumpish stuff, or was it Biden people doing early Bidenish stuff? And that's the thing no one's quite sure about.
Go ahead, Fran.
Yeah, but Jim, it might have existed because I read somewhere that it is the same IP address, the same physical address, and the same name, except for the difference between corporation, which it was 10 years ago, and LLC, which it is now, that kind of resurfaced. So there's some really kind of, you know, odd details about this.
There definitely are.
I mean, Jim is exactly right, Ray. And I just wanted to add a few things for folks as to, you know, why it matters and to step back, you know, even another 50,000 foot. Because one of the things that some listeners definitely know and some listeners don't know is that IP addresses, you know, addresses of all of the different devices you have, your computer, your cell phone, etc., over the last decades have gone through a shift when people were worried that we would run out of addresses. So we have gone from these kinds of addresses, which are IPv4, which are made for 32-bit computers, they're 32-bit addresses, to IPv6, which are 128-bit addresses. And one of the reasons, there are a number of reasons for that, but one of the reasons for that is today, everything is connected. I think the general statistic is there are 7 connected devices for every person in the world on average. And so you run out of address space. You know, on your street, if you have 10 houses, you can use a one-digit address space. If you have 10 more houses on your street, you have to go to more digits. And so this part of the address space that the DoD had is in the older address space, the IPv4 address space. So there's all kinds of sort of interesting details on that as to why it was sort of fallow for a while and all of that. Another thing that's really interesting is what this part of the DoD was interested in, and they call themselves the SWAT team of nerds. So what the SWAT team of nerds wanted to do is they actually wanted to analyze all of the kind of digital vulnerabilities that we see today, you know, hacking and threats and breaches and breaks and, you know, cyber war and cyber espionage. And they wanted to look at the unauthorized use of this address space that they now made available. So there's all kinds of, you know, complexity and details. And in addition to the mystery of sort of why they did it, you know, 3 minutes before a change in administration. But, you know, at the end of the day, if we find out more about what's dangerous and what's not, and we know more about the technologies that surround us every day, you know, that can be helpful. And but there's lots to know about this one.
Yep.
Alan, have you glazed over, sir?
Well, no, not at all. I'm fascinated by this. I act out of a certain number of prejudices, one of which Fran just announced, which was it comes out of the Trump administration on their way out the door. And my original reaction is can't be good. Somebody knew more. So we can ascribe this to either positive or negative. I don't know. But, you know, doesn't sound kosher to me. That's for sure. And that's with not knowing anything. That's why I'm glad we have these two experts on the air with us.
That was fun, Fran Berman and Jim Hendler. And
and the good news is we'll be keeping an eye on it for you guys.
Oh, Trump.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it.
Can you get us an update, Ray, on a day when I'm not hosting? That would be very good.
Yeah, Jim and I are on the job.
Ray, I have a quick point to make.
Sure, go ahead, Dorsey, please. Yep.
And I feel it has audit written all over it. I think the U.S. Government Accountability Office should definitely conduct an audit on this. We saw during the early stages of the COVID crisis that, you know, people really take advantage of a crisis, and people were standing up businesses in short order, selling PPE from China, fake addresses. I experienced a situation in which I looked up someone who was looking to do business with the city, and when I did a simple Google search, it was a Starbucks. And so, you know, we definitely need some accountability here, and a very critical eye looking into the intent of this quote unquote pilot.
Very interesting indeed. All right, Jim, I'll give you 10 seconds here and we're going to wrap it up, and then I'll give Fran a few seconds as well, and Alan will get 1 second. Jim, go ahead.
Just to say, I think Dorsey makes a good point. I mean, we got to keep an eye on this and make sure this really is going for good stuff and not bad.
Fran Berman.
I just want to, you know, make a pitch for public knowledge about what's going on in the digital world. I think we don't need to know how the operating system of our iPhone works, but we do need to know what's going on and what it means for us. And, you know, so I don't think it should be just Jim and I keeping an eye on this. I think we all need sort of the knowledge and the skills, tech defense and tech offense, to be able to deal with the digital world we're in so it's safe for us.
Well, let me ask you a question, Fran. Tech defense, it's huge, right? In other words, protecting, in the old days, a power grid or a power station, it was not connected to anything. If it broke down, a guy went out and tried to fix it as best he could. But everything's connected now. Is there such a thing as too much public information about the underpinnings of our entire framework? In other words, more people know, the more bad people know as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good point. And you have to realize that the tech we experience is part tech innovation and it's part social control. You know, society sets the controls about what's private, what's not, what our standards for cybersecurity should be. And, you know, we've been kind of, you know, a little lame on the society side, you know, and so tech has become more and more of a Wild West. But so what you and I experience is not as private as it could be. It's not as safe as it could be. It's not as secure as it could be. And that's really important. When you get behind the wheel of a self-driving car, you don't want it to crash. When you get an implanted pacemaker, which sends data to your doctor, which is really good for you, you don't want somebody to be able to hack it.
All right.
So I do think that public knowledge and, you know, in university space, this comes under the guise of public interest technology, is just a general education requirement for all of us who want to be citizens in the 21st century.
Hey, we are
done. We need to know a little bit about it.
Hey, my friends, we're out of time here, but thank you all. Fran Berman, Jim Hendler, Dorcia Pliers, Alan Shartok, thank you all for listening. More good stuff coming.